session number 23228, Rule 6.
Professor Hugh de Wardener, Rule 6.
Yes, you want to know more about the Japanese?
Yes, it would be interesting. You were saying eventually they gave an occupation.
Yes, I mean, their whole attitude... I mean, from the point of view of the railway, we were expendable, clearly. And they brought up, as you well know, huge numbers of Asians from Malaya, Tamils, I don't know where else from, and Java. They used to go and put on a film show. And, of course, the whole village would turn up. And then they'd corral the whole bunch and send them up to the railway. And their treatment and things that happened to them were in many ways, I mean, on an average, far, far worse than us. And far many more died than us. It was terrible. And the cholera, for instance, I mean, there were corpses everywhere, floating down the river and in the camps and other people's experience. I didn't experience any of this, but a friend of mine called John Coast, I mean, he saw Nip, who was involved in putting these people, or organizing these people to be put into, the dead ones to be put into a pit. And there was one stood up, or sat up, and the Nip just hit him with a spade and then pushed him in. I mean, that sort of thing. I mean, callous, and nothing against them, for goodness sake. Might have said against us, nothing against them at all. This is the famous co-prosperity sphere, remember? The Nipponese co-prosperity sphere. Yes. And, of course, we at least had our organization. We still held on to our military structure. And the Nips were very clever. They used our military structure to save them a lot of trouble. And we preferred it that way. Clearly, it was much better to have our colonels talking to their colonels and passing things on down, as opposed to having no structure of our own and just being hounded around by a lot of Nips. So it suited us, it suited them. But the Asians had no structure at all. No sanitary people, no nothing at all. They were just herded about. And, their deaths, I don't know how many, and I don't know if anybody's ever measured it. I forget how many of ours died, but for every one that, of ours, I'm sure about 10 of theirs did. So that was more about the Japanese. Medically, they were very poor. But I don't think they cared. That was the point. Didn't worry. Why? I have a feeling that they themselves didn't care, but they somehow or other felt that the figures they were giving might be important. I have a feeling that they were constrained about. That's why they were saying that there wasn't cholera, that there wasn't diphtheria. They were trying to avoid having to say that things were not good in the camp. I think there was a bit of that. I think inherently they didn't mind. But there was probably somebody overlooking the whole thing who thought it was a poor show to have the working team decimated. And it was their fault of being decimated, so they were in a sort of funny state. The other thing, of course, about being a prisoner of the Japanese was that a lot of the guards were Koreans. And if there's one low form of life, it's a Korean. It's a lower form of life than the Japanese. Oh, yes. Now, that was our experience, and of course, they were in a bad position. They were being pushed around by the Japanese. They were being used as third, fourth-rate troops to look after prisoners. They had no standing with the Nips at all. So they, the Koreans, took it out on us, with the encouragement, and obviously... I had one Korean sergeant once who told me that he had been bitten by a mosquito on his private parts, and could I have a look at them? So I had a look, and he had a syphilitic chancre. So I told him what he had, and he said, what do I do about it? I said, well, you have to get some arsenic. Penicillin didn't exist at those days, certainly there. And so he wanted to know the name of it and so on. I told him. He went into Bangkok to buy some. His story was that the pharmacist said he didn't have any. So he got his gun out and he said, now where is it? And he came back with some. And I had to inject the salvarsan intravenously once a week to cure him of his syphilis. He was such a bastard, this fellow. He used to kick people's ulcers. You know, they had ulcers on their legs. And on parade, he would kick their ulcers. He would beat people up. And one day, when he behaved appallingly, I'm afraid that my ethical standing slipped a bit. And it was the last injection. And it's very irritant, this stuff, if it gets out of the vein. And it was a big injection. It was about 10 ml. He had to get a big 10 ml syringe and so on. So I gave him 9 ml up the vein. I took the needle out a little bit, and I put 1 ml subcutaneously, which hurt like hell. This was his right arm. And, well, all right. Not exactly what Hippocrates would have done, but... And the only trouble is this made him more vicious than ever. You see, he, instead of hitting people with the right hand, he took his stick with his left hand. Yes, the Koreans were awful. Japanese, yes. There was, you see, you had to go out onto the railway to see the worst of it. From our end, it was the continuous fight of the Japanese sending out the sick. That's what we saw of them. I was beaten up once or twice, but not very seriously. I mean, not beaten up. I was smacked. I mean, a smack, you know, that was, they started from somewhere near the ground and came up wallop. It wasn't just like this. I mean, it came up woof. But they did it to themselves, between themselves. I mean, it's a Nipponese trick to slap each other in the army. So I don't think they thought they were behaving particularly badly if they did it to a prisoner. And... that was my experience with the Japanese doctors and the Japanese sergeant and the Korean sergeant. I knew of one Japanese that was murdered by the prisoners. That's the story. I mean, I had no reason to disbelieve it. But that was at Chiang Kai, nearer the end, where we're talking about Japanese. We had two brothers, the Weber brothers. I can't remember their Christian names. The two Weber brothers who ran a radio, and they listened for the news. And I shall never forget. Now, I've gone back to Chiang Kai now, but never mind. And I remember going, and they used to give us, the medical mess, the news. But otherwise, they gave it to about 10 people, and those 10 gave it to other 10, and that's how it went on, you see. And I remember once coming in, and I may be overdoing it, but something like this. He said, this is the 250th consecutive bulletin. Now, the bravery of that. Phenomenal. Phenomenal bravery. I think he got an OBE or something, but poof. Like, come on. That. It, 24 hours a day, day after day, being under the... I mean, others were found with wirelesses, and they were tortured. And you could hear their yells. And then they were shot. And it just took days. And these two brothers, nevertheless, ran this radio. And at the end, I'm going on now, but at the end, when the camp was moved, and I had trouble like this too, because at the end they were searching everybody on moves, he hid the parts of his wireless in the Nipponese wireless. The colonel had a wireless. The colonel asked him to fix it or something, and he put his own wireless in there. They were marvellous, the Weber brothers. They really were. I mean, you know, past the bravery of that. If I did it for one night, I'd have diarrhoea for a week. I mean, they did it every night. So we had news. You said we got a desultory news. No, we had very accurate news throughout. It was only when they were at the main camp. So, of course, if you left the main camp, you had to get it from people who passed through or something like that. So you were a bit late. But if you were in the main camp, it was good.
So what was the source of the news? You know, which station?
Radio India, I think. Yes, BBC India, I think, yes. Otherwise, what can I think about the Japanese? I mean, I think you see that basically they're a feudal society who have been run by very erudite, clever, intelligent nobility. Thousands of years of various kinds. And I think that's why they love the Americans so much. The Americans gave them a vote. For the first time in their lives, they had a say in what happened. But deep, deep down, the genes that they acquired were the genes suitable for being a serf. And they'll continue to be serfs for many hundreds of years, deep down. You tell them to do something, somebody authoritative enough, they'll do it. Basically, the authority is very important, terribly important. You have those who go overboard at the moment, there are a bunch of those, but basically, that's... One met good Nips, there were good Nips, there's no question about that.
Can you remember any?
Oh yes, I remember his name, but I remember we had one Nip. I'm going on a bit, but we're talking about Nips, we're sort of concertina older Nips.
That's okay, yes.
Well, yes, but he was in a small camp, because I haven't left Takanoon yet, but when I leave Takanoon, I go to Chiang Kai and I talk about Chiang Kai, and then I go back again up the river, and we were in a very small camp, only about 100, a maintenance camp, and we had a Nip sergeant in charge, and he was marvelous. He really did try the best he could to do everything. I mean, and without not being smarmy or anything, I mean, I'm not certain he wasn't Christian, not certain. But he was a solid, efficient, on the ball, wanted to know. And we didn't have much meat at this camp. We never had much meat, but particularly at this camp. And there were buffaloes about, wild buffaloes. And he went out and shot one. I mean, at our instigation, but he had the courage to go and shot. Now, come on, he shot a wild buffalo with a high-speed small bullet. Now, you know, a wounded buffalo is no joke. And he shot one with this thing. Now, it's a very high velocity, so you can be sure it'll go in. But it won't do much damage because it's small. And it was wounded, and he chased after it, and he got it again. I mean, you know, he was brave. He really was brave. But I don't think anybody would say that the Japanese aren't brave. But this was not brave in the sense of being brave for the emperor or the war. And there was nothing to impel him except doing something for us. So, and I'll come to it later, but we put on a pantomime there, and he wanted to know all about it, and so on. He's good. He was all right. And then the colonel... At Takanoon, the colonel of the group, he had the wit to make the cattle walk up the rail, up the road to us. Up to then, people had been trying to get the meat up. Well, of course, it went bad. There was no refrigeration. He had the wit to make them walk up. They're pretty small, you know. The cattle are about this high. And he was tried at... at Singapore after the war, and they found him guilty. They were going to hang him, and I wasn't involved, though I approved of it. We made representations and saved his life, and I'm glad we did. But I think he tried his best. So there were good Nips, there were terrible Nips. The whole mentality on the whole was uncaring, and I mean, they had a wonderful workforce, a white workforce. I mean, we had Tamils working beside us. Well, you have to look away to make certain the towel's moving. You know, when he's working. We can't move that slowly. We had a discipline running themselves, workforce. Now, with a little care and attention, we did do a bit of sabotage, we did do a bit of this, that, that, but however much however much go slow we did, we could do 10 times more than the other workforce they could get. So it was stupid, stupid. Yes, there was a bit of sabotage. These embankments that we made, you know, building a railway is a question of embankments, bridges and cuttings. That is a railway. Through the hills, you make a cutting. Over the gap, you make a bridge. And along the flat, it's an embankment. You know, build it up a bit. And they were... And the embankments, sometimes quite high embankments, the people used to put logs, huge logs. Well, you can imagine what happens to that, because they disappear. What was that? That was the first, but that came back to that roosted later on. Right. Well, now we're still at Takanoon.
Yes.
I think I've done with my Japanese at the moment.
Is there anything more to say about the Japanese doctors? You know, the sort of medical people.
No.
And their standards or lack of standards.
Well, I can't tell about this. I can only tell about the ludicrous actions of a couple that I met, and the inefficiency of the cholera people. That's all. I mean,
did you know what resources they had? Did you have any idea whether they had access to vitamins and drugs?
Well, they're bound to have. They made them in Japan. Mm-hmm. And certainly, the Japanese are amongst the best bacteriologists in the world. That's well known. I mean, there was a famous bacteriologist in New York called Flexner. And Flexner was a bastard, apparently. He was the most difficult person to work with. And so the only people who would ever go and work with him were the Japanese. And so a series of Japanese went and worked with Flexner. And they all came back and made great names for themselves. Like Shiga is a Japanese. So I don't know if anyone can remember. But several well-known Japanese. Chuchugabushi fever. I mean, I haven't said all the various things I got. But one of the things I got was Yes, Chuchugamushi fever. It's a tick-borne fever. And it lasts for 3 weeks. Temperature 103, 104 every evening. And I can tell you, by the 10th day, you're beginning to think, when is this going to finish? Because you feel a bit better in the morning. At first you think it's malaria, and you take a lot of quinine, because we did have some, and nothing happened. It only makes you feel sick, so there's no point in going on with it. On and on and on and on. And it was so hot, too. I remember I still had my camp bed with me. Went very shortly after, but I still had it. And the camp bed had cloth, and then at the joints there was plain wood. And the plain wood was too hot in the shade to put your hand on. I remember, mind you, I was pretty hot, too. So, but that gives you some idea of the heat. What? And that's the heat that these people were working under. I'm complaining about being in the shade, being sick. They're working in the sun in that heat. But 3 weeks, on and on and on. It wasn't the worst illness from the point of view of how you felt, but it was one that got me pretty low down, because I thought it was never going to finish. By the end of the second, you know, 2.5 weeks, you think, well, this is never going to finish. Chuchugamushi fever. The other thing I had, the worst thing I had was jaundice. This was rife. There was always jaundice about. You know, you didn't have epidemics of jaundice. There was endemic jaundice. People were developing jaundice here and there all the time. And that was the worst one. There's no question about it. You feel as if you've got a big lead balloon in the upper part of your abdomen, getting bigger the whole time. And whichever way you turn, however you, there is this big balloon ever expanding. Ah, day after day, night after night. And at first, of course, you're not yellow, so you don't know what's the matter with yourself. And this feeling is due to the swelling of the liver, which is contained by a fibrous capsule, and the swelling contained in the capsule gives tremendous pressure inside, and that's what gives you this feeling, and you are feeling as if expanded. And this went on for 2 or 3 days, and I remember somebody was cooking outside on coconut oil. Coconut oil fumes when you're developing jaundice, can you imagine? And also there was a bird at the top of this tree. And instead of going, now how does a cuckoo go? A cuckoo goes, cuckoo, cuckoo. This bird went, cuckoo, cuckoo, cuckoo. On. I remember staggering out and throwing sticks at it. It was much too high. Ah, and eventually one day I went out to pee, and there was the urine, bright yellow. Ah, I have jaundice. Up to that moment, I didn't know what was the matter with me. And from then on, you begin to feel better. That's the funny thing. Yes, that's very, very, very often. The jaundice is sort of the last thing to turn up. You have all these symptoms beforehand. But that, from the point of view of feeling bad, I mean, I've had all sorts of things since. I've had TB, I've had a cardiac arrest, I've had all sorts of things. But the jaundice, oh no, I don't want that again. I'll swap any of the others. Yes, jaundice is terrible. And the worst thing, right at the end, I got better. I felt very hungry. So hungry, I went and bought myself some food. I bought 6 duck eggs, made an omelette, and ate it, and thought I'd die. I really did. Can you imagine being a doctor? And being so stupid as to eat 6 duck eggs. They're terribly fatty. Oh, all the symptoms came back for about 12 hours. Oh, awful. So those are illnesses. What else? Any other illnesses? Chuchugamushi, 15 attacks of malaria, dysentery. I had amoebic dysentery. When I came back, it was discovered I had amoebic dysentery. But I didn't spot it there. I had dysentery once or twice. Oh, I had cholera, I think. Yes, I wanted to mention that. A little bit. What happened? This was during the cholera epidemic, but not in time for this famous injection by the mouth that I had. I was in my tent, and I got up at night to go to the lavatory, and I had a profuse diarrhea. Well, that was unusual. I mean, dysentery, you don't have profuse diarrhea. You pass blood and mucus, you pass a little feces, but not profuse. So I thought, uh-oh. And I went back to bed, and an hour or two later, I got up again, this time an enormous amount, and hardly fecal. And I thought, oh, God. And I did it once more. And then I went back, and I remember this feeling of exhaustion. And I remember thinking, I wonder if this is it. And I remember not caring too much. That was the interesting thing. I was not frightened by it. And that gives you some idea of the exhaustion of the disease. I mean, I wasn't suffering pain. I mean, once I'd had the diarrhea, I felt all right. And I staggered back to the tent, lay down, woke up the next morning feeling fine. It was incredible. I think that was a baby one, because dysentery doesn't do this. That's not dysentery. Not sure I knew dysentery. I looked after it, I had it. No. So I think I had enough immunity to suppress it that much, you know.
Did you get any of the sores you described?
No, I didn't have tropical sores. No, I had pellagra. I had beriberi, a little bit.
Could you describe beriberi?
Beriberi, well, I had swollen feet and numbness of the feet and the hands for a while. That's about as far as it got.
Is it a killing disease, beriberi?
If you go far enough, yes. Well, Wernicke's is part of it, yes. But people usually recover. It usually follows some incident. I mean, you are sick, and you don't, and you're on the edge of it. because of your diet, but you're just managing. And then you have dysentery, you don't eat for a while, you increase the demand, and you slip into it, and then you start eating again, you just go back into it. But what I had was pellagra, and that was fascinating because I didn't recognize it at first. But pellagra gives you pigmentation and a sort of purple rash. And I woke up one morning and I had this rash on my both where the sun goes, the sun-affected parts. And usually the back of the neck is the famous thing, back of the hands. I woke up one morning and I had this purple rash on my hand, but I didn't recognize it as pellagra. Then I looked at it again, and it was, the edges were sharp. Well, that's a very funny rash. You never have a rash where the edges are sharp unless you've, I mean, it's artificial, isn't it? You had something covering it, and the edge is sharp. And of course, I then realized, no, that's pellagra. Yes. So I ate a few more green things and got over that. So I had pellagra. What else? Pellagra, scabies, I've done. Scabies, yes. Plenty of lice. Bed bugs incessantly. Horrible things. Bed bugs, one used to take one's slats. They used to sit in the grooves of the slat. You take your slats out and put them over the fire. Make a bonfire and sort of grill your slats to get rid of bed bugs. Yes, well, now let's get back to Tarkanoon. Shall we?
Sometimes, are there disadvantages to knowing so much about medicine when you are yourself?
Oh no, it's an advantage. Oh no, it's better. You know what's going on. Yes, yeah. I mean, particularly getting older, it's been marvelous because I'm getting one thing after another, and I know the measure of it. I don't have to think now. What's he telling me? What's going to happen? What might happen? Because doctors are bloody awful at telling you anything. They really are. I'm ashamed of doctors. They never discuss things properly, as far as I can see. Never. But perhaps they think I know it. I don't know. But sometimes I don't, after all.
And in your situation then, you know, for instance, knowing you had cholera and these other diseases, you know, you would know what this meant, really, wouldn't you? You'd be very realistic about your chances.
Yes, after all, I didn't just have anything that was likely to kill me, did I? I mean, I didn't know about the cholera, I must admit. That's touch and go. But the exhaustion of that took away all the fear. That was fascinating. I mean, when he vomited in my mouth, I had great fear. But when I thought I had it myself, I didn't have any fear. I had a sort of distant anxiety, but not an immediate fear. I had anxiety about the future, but let the future look after itself. Let me go to bed. Let me sleep. Let me, you know. That was the feeling. Not a gnawing fear.